Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the great producer-engineer Sylvia Massey. But first of all, it was in the news that Sound Exchange paid $162 million a year. Now, if you don't know about Sound Exchange, it's a nonprofit association that collects royalties from online and satellite radio. But it doesn't distribute to songwriters. No, it distributes to performing artists and rights holders, which is interesting because performing artists don't get money from getting radio airplay, but they do if the radio station plays them online. So for online radio, for satellite radio, for Pandora, for instance, they all have to pay a royalty to the performer and to the rights holder. Now, the way this is actually doled out, 45% goes to the artist, 50% goes to the rights holder, in other words, who owns the master, and 5% goes to featured performers like backup musicians or session players. Now, the reason why I bring that up is if you're not a member of Sound Exchange, you should go there now and register, because if you've played on songs that have been on satellite radio or even web radio, you may be entitled to some money. Sound Exchange is paid to 32,000 different payees, and that's 20% higher than last year. The problem is it's collecting less money these days, and the reason why Pandora is now doing direct licenses with rights holders. So when that happened, in fact, there's less money now coming in to Sound Exchange. Nonetheless, there still is a good amount of money there. So if it's a possibility that you're owed some dough, you should go to soundexchange.com to register. Sound Exchange, SoundExchange, just the way it sounds, all one word, soundexchange.com. There might be some royalties there for you. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. If you want to learn more about the basics of mixing, sign up for my 4-week Music Mixing Primer webinar course. Go to mixingprimer.com to learn more. Also, check out my new Hitmakers Club for access to a powerful online group, all of my courses, monthly workshops and Q&A webinars, core basic training, and much, much more. Go to hitmakersclub.com to find out all about it. Now, next thing, has virtual reality flamed out? Yeah, it hasn't even caught on yet, and it looks like it may be over. The reason why is nobody likes the headsets. Everybody hates them. And the fact of the matter is, there just hasn't been the killer app yet. Now, games may, in fact, be the killer app, but if you're not a game player, it doesn't mean much to you. Now, that being said, it looks like we're going to make the leap past virtual reality to something called augmented reality. Or, many are now calling it mixed reality. What is that? Well, basically, it's like Google Glass, if you remember that. So, in other words, you're wearing some glasses, and let's say you're walking through a store. Instead of having to pick up a can of beans, for instance, and look at it and find out what the price, just by scanning it with your glasses, you can see all about it, all the ingredients, as well as the price, any deals that might be had. Same thing as you're walking down the street, and just by looking at landmarks, it can be pulling up a Wikipedia page for you so you can learn more about it. So that's mixed reality. Very much like the Pokemon Go craze that just happened, where you're looking at your phone and it's superimposing a computer display on top of reality. So this seems to be the next thing. It's funny, a friend of mine called me yesterday and he asked me, what do you know about the company Magic Leap? It turns out that Magic Leap raised about $1.4 billion from some real heavyweights. Google, some big Silicon Valley investors, Alibaba, which is basically the Amazon of China. And the reason why is they're working on some interesting new hardware. They're working on what's known as a light field chip using silicon photonics. What does that mean? Basically, it's electronics and display built into the glass that you might have in your glasses, sunglasses, or reading glasses. So this would be a giant leap forward. One of the big problems with both virtual reality and with augmented reality is the fact that you have to wear a headset. And it's even worse with augmented reality because it takes so much computer power that you'd be walking around with a belt pack or something. And nobody wants to do that. So Magic Leap is working on some new breakthroughs that might be very interesting. One of the problems with Magic Leap, though, is it may be a lot of smoke and mirrors because it looks like they're one of those companies that are good at raising money and not really good at actually producing a product. So we'll have to see. But regardless of what happens, the big thing is augmented reality is going to be the way to go. Many are calling it mixed reality, so just keep your eye open because immersive audio will go along with it. My guest today is producer-engineer Sylvia Massey, who's worked with a wide variety of artists, including Queens of the Stone Age, Black Crowes, Sheryl Crow, Smashing Pumpkins, Johnny Cash, Prince, Tool, Lenny Kravitz, and many more. She's also recently published her first book entitled Recording Unhinged that should be on every audio person's bookshelf. I admire Sylvia for her ability to think outside the box and be willing to experiment in the studio, which we'll hear about in our upcoming conversation. I spoke with Sylvia via Skype from her home in Oregon. How did you move there? Because it seemed like you had a great thing going in weed.
Yeah, it's divorce. And then I was just, always liked the town of Ashland. Weed is very small. So I went up north and just 60 miles north of Weed. And now there's culture here. There's sushi bars. There's theater, you know, so.
Makes a difference.
So, it does make a difference. And I'm done with the ranching life. So I'm back kind of in the city, even though it's a city of like 25,000 people, you know.
Yeah. Tell me a little about your journey, because you started as a player. You were a drummer, right?
I am a drummer and a singer. I actually started as a singer and learned to play drums after I became a producer, because I really wanted to understand what a drummer needs in the setup. So, you know, if my mics were going to be in the way. So I learned how to set up a kit, and then I learned some basic beats, and now I just love to drum. I'm not that good at it, but I can keep a steady beat, you know?
Okay.
And I hit hard.
But you started in a band as a singer. Not only that, you're in Northern California, right? Where it all started. So how did you get from there to being a producer engineer in Los Angeles? Because it's an interesting transition.
Right. Well, when I finished college, and when I say I finished it, it's not that I graduated, but I just left. I went to school in Chico and moved down to the Bay Area. I got interested in recording in college, though, because I was hanging out at the radio station, which at the time was playing the first generation of punk rock, and I loved it. So when I left college and moved back to San Francisco, I had some all-girl rock bands, punk rock band and a metal band, and that's where I started in writing music. And that transitioned into a studio job at a place called Bear West in San Francisco. And I met Mark Needham there. He was, I think that was the first session I was ever on, was with Mark Needham. And later I went and met up with Matt Wallace, who was an early friend. And I got some opportunities there to work with some up and coming bands. One was called the Sea Hags, and they were being produced by Kirk Hammett, who was the new guitar player from Metallica. And he and I co-produced this record with the Sea Hags, and it did so well that they got a deal with Chrysalis Records in Los Angeles. And I thought, well, this is my big break. Finally, I've got a band that I can follow and into this label deal. But they went and to LA and worked with Mike Klink instead. So
funny how that works.
Yeah, and I learned a lesson there. I learned that if I was really serious about my career, that I would really need to get up and move to where the work was, and that was in Los Angeles. So when I first moved to Los Angeles, I couldn't really get a studio job. I thought, here, I'd had all this experience, but it didn't really mean much. When you go into LA, you're starting from scratch, basically. So I started working at Tower Records on Sunset, and that's where I met a group from Buffalo, New York, who was also had gone to LA to try to break into the music industry. And they're called Green Jelly or Green Jello at the time. They were forced to change their name to Green Jelly after they had some hits, and we did their debut record together, and it did really well. There was a song called Three Little Pigs, and a couple of the players on that song were in another band called Tool. So that's how I connected with Tool. And in the meantime, I had been working in as an assistant in some other studios. I graduated from Tower Records and started working at first Lionchair and then Larrabee Sound. And that's where I was able to do a lot of the early records. The Green Jello was done there, mixed there, and I got a lot of great experience at Larrabee. Larrabee was a great studio. It's where I connected with Prince and wound up working with Prince for several years. And I connected with Rick Rubin there, and then also worked with Rick on several projects through the 90s.
Did you have a mentor?
I would say I've had several mentors. Dave Pensado is one. Matt Wallace is another. Rick Rubin, I can't express how much I learned from Rick. And there's so many. I would have to say Keith Casey Cohen was really important in my growth as a mixer. So yeah, there's several people that I was able to sit in on their sessions and learn from them.
Do you consider yourself a producer first or an engineer first?
That's hard to say because my thought on what a producer does can go in three di different directions. One is the producer as a musician. The second is the producer as an engineer. And the third is a producer as a fan. And I kind of consider myself an engineer producer first. Well, actually, I'm a fan first, but I know how to use the equipment. So I use my skills as an engineer to get the sounds that I want and to manipulate the music and the performer to get what I want out of that too. I collaborate with musicians and I use the equipment to make their ideas happen. And sometimes I'll throw in some ideas that they like them too, so we do it together. I love the idea of being a producer, and even if I am an engineer, I'm always just adding that bit of extra effort into it to help produce the tracks. I'm rarely hired as just an engineer anymore, so I'm almost always in the role of producer.
You seem pretty fearless in terms of what you try in order to get a sound that kind of works. And I've seen some of the videos, the turntable video and the pickles video, just amazing. So how did those come about? Did this come from you? Did you hear it from somebody and decide to try it? And again, you have to be fearless in order to convince somebody that, hey, let's put a pickle in line and see what happens. How did that happen?
Well, it comes from several different things. The very first things that I did in a professional recording environment, I added that little bit of wackiness into it, I guess. The Tool record, I thought would be a good experiment to make the largest, most cacophonous sound that I could find, that I could create. And this was a band that was all for that idea. So the first thought was, well, let's get a crane and get a piano and hoist the piano up on a crane and drop it and record that. But I couldn't find a crane operator who would go for that. So we settled on just buying some old wrecked pianos. These pianos from the 1800s generally are totaled. They make sound, but they can't be fixed, you know. They can't actually stay in tune anymore. So we got a couple of those, and then I went to the hardware store and got sledgehammers and safety goggles and gloves, and they brought a sawed-off shotgun, and we took all that into the studio at Grandmaster in L.A., and we recorded with something that became Disgustipated on the Undertow record. And it was so exciting, and it wasn't necessarily that the sounds were really useful. In fact, a lot of the experiments I do in the studio may not result in usable sounds at all, but it's the memory of doing that is imprinted into the music. Somehow there's a sense of adventure that you can hear in when you listen to an album where we've done something like we threw a guitar off a cliff, or we recorded in the back of a van, or, you know, any of these kind of fun things. You can imagine how much better a session would be if you just spent a day just experimenting with sound. I mean, that's really what it's about.
I admire that greatly, because it's not something that I would readily consider. And when I think about it, I think, well, why not? Because I understand where you're coming from. Exactly. It loosens up the session, it loosens up the mood. How can it not be better as a result?
And the artist in particular will find out that there are no boundaries in what they can do. If they want to invent a new instrument or play something backwards, or, you know, when I throw ideas out, most often they'll throw new ideas at me, and then we collaborate on some crazy things. The fun stuff that I've been doing lately has really been out of my ignorance for how electronics actually work. And I have to be very careful and wear rubber gloves when I'm not sure what I'm doing. But I like to connect things together that don't necessarily belong together. And I've blown up some amps, but I've learned a lot. And one of the things I've done lately is to take a regular speaker cable, which connects let's say a guitar head to a speaker, and just cut it in half, and then I'll insert things into that speaker cable, because I wanted to know, does the audio go through, let's say, a potato? Will that audio from a speaker cable go through a potato? And in fact, it does. A potato acts as an attenuator, but it also adds a kind of there's a high shelf. And so it makes things a little shimmery, you know? And so I thought, well, that was interesting. And we actually measured it to see how much attenuation there was and what kind of frequency changes were happening as a potato filter. So you do the same experiment, let's say, with a hot dog. Surprisingly, a hot dog is less of an attenuator, and the hot dog is basically flat. It doesn't, you know, you'll get audio pretty much the same way into a hot dog or out of a hot dog as you put into it. But things got really interesting when you, instead of a hot dog, you use a cheese dog or a cheese sausage. I swear the sound is different. It's grainy. There's much more distortion in cheese sausage. So, you know, I hope everyone gets a chance to try some of these things, but I recommend that you use solid state amplifiers, because the tubes will they just hate that stuff, and that you'll blow up some amps. Ed Cherney, who's one of my mentors, I love that guy. He told me a story about how he used to plug in various appliances into speaker cables like this. So I've really gone overboard with that now. I built a special rig so I can plug in any number of kitchen appliances or power tools or whatever into in line between the amplifier and the speaker. And the interesting thing is, if you play a low B, which is around 60 hertz, with a bass a bass instrument, like a bass guitar or a regular guitar, maybe tuned down. Whatever you plug into it, these appliances will start up because the motors will start up. You're running audio through the electronics, the power electronics of the motor, and you hear that filter. But then the 60 hertz is the same thing that comes out of a wall socket.
Yeah.
So it starts motors up. Now you've got the sound of the guitar being filtered through the electronics of the motor, and you get the sound, these strange harmonics from the motor running. It's just a fascinating sound, and I'm still experimenting with that to see how far we can go. And when I realized that the motors were going to start up, I thought, well, 60 hertz will light up a light bulb, won't it? So I put into my rig some lamps and incandescent bulbs. You can imagine the filament in an incandescent bulb, the material of the filament, the different materials will affect the audio differently. So I'm still experimenting with that, but I found incandescent bulbs will light right up when you put a audio through it. And fluorescent bulbs, those curly bulbs, add this incredibly beautiful distortion. But I'm still experimenting. I haven't yet tried neon. I'm really interested in neon. But I should just go back to school and learn about this. But I'm afraid if I actually learn things from in a formal setting, that it will discourage me from trying some of these things.
I think that's absolutely true. Now, I've been fixing amplifiers since I was a kid, and I've been thrown across the room lots of times by touching the wrong thing, you know, and getting 400 volts going through you, and literally getting thrown 10 feet into the wall. It gave me enough respect to not try something like that. Now, and only because it would be like, oh, I remember what happened when I did something when I was a kid, you know? So
right.
I think sometimes knowing too much about it will actually keep you from experimenting.
Well, I get a lot of people on Facebook. I have some friends who really say, you know, just be careful. And I am careful. And I'll get some advice on trying certain things before I attempt it, just so I don't have one of those experiences that you're talking about so far. Knock on wood, you know, that hasn't happened.
Yeah, the interesting thing is when you get hit by high voltage, especially on your finger, I remember I had a little blue dot on one side and it came out the other side and there's a big red welt.
Wow.
Yeah. So memories like that don't go away.
Yeah, right. Respect.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Well, I'm just, you know, audio. That's different, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I still have to maintain respect.
Tell me about your 8038. How'd you come across that?
It was while I was in Milton Keynes in the UK. I was doing a record with a band called Skunk Anansie. And the owner of the studio where I was, which was the studio was Great Linford Manor. He had this fabulous Emmy Neve with 1081 EQs. And I kind of joked with him about it. I said, you know, if you ever find an old Neve that's for sale with some the classic 1272 preamps, let me know because I want to buy it. And he came in the next day and said, I found one for you. And it was at CTS in London, which is a film studio. And it was being used to mix the James Bond movies, you know, the soundtracks. And they had two identical consoles, two 8038s. And I managed to actually buy this console and have it shipped over from the UK. And the first place it went was the Studio B in Sound City, and it lived there for a long time. But I got to know the old Neves during the Tool days when I was working at Grandmaster, and they had an 8028 in there. And, of course, Sound City, they also had an 8028 that I loved. So it was my my dream to have a similar console. And this desk, I've had it ever since. It's still here. It's in Ashland, and I use it just about every day. I don't mix on it like I used to, because I'm in the box with the mixing, but I will always track on it if I can, or something similar with the.
Oh, okay. Well, tell me about that. So you made the transition to in the box. Was that voluntary, or was it because you were always asked to do recalls?
Well, you're right. Yes. The recalls are the biggest problem with working analog. And even though I had a fabulous setup with flying faders on the old Neve, you really are always going to be limited, unless you're Chris Lord Alge, on how many compressors you can put on each channel.
Yeah.
And so I've kept all the equipment that I can. I mean, I'm not letting go of anything for tracking, but it's so wonderful to be in the box. There was a time when I first attempted to mix in the box, and there was very limited plugins available, and they didn't exactly sound that great either, especially the EQ. But now that's changed. I think that the EQ is much better. It's very versatile, and especially the stereo bus EQs and stereo bus compression, which I find is really important in mixing. It's really quite good now. So I'm all the way in the box for mixing, and it's really easy to do long distance mixes and recallable. And there are problems with that, though, because clients will continue to change and tweak and nitpick about things for months. So it's a little bit harder to get things done. There was that great time when you finished a mix on the Neve and you printed it, and there it is. That's it. You know?
Yeah, right.
Never changes. Or the ridiculousness of maybe mixing at Larrabee, where we would have a bass up 0.5, bass up 1 point, you know,
yeah.
Vocal up, vocal down, you know, just dozens of alternate mixes, which was so time consuming to print every single one. But that was the gig at the time. No wonder it was so expensive to do mixing back then.
You know, it's funny, I'm sure you get this, but occasionally I'll get somebody that will say, yeah, can you go back and redo that mix and bring up the hi-hat 1 dB in the chorus? I'm going, in 2 weeks, you're never going to hear the difference of this 1 dB. You're not going to hear it now, but in 2 weeks, you're going to forget about the whole thing. What, you know, this is a waste of time for both of us. And it just makes me crazy. And I'm sure you go through the same thing.
Yeah, I'm working with a group right now that they're a baby band, and they're great. But they have, you know, pages of notes on these mixes that are just like little teeny things. Like, I can't hear the ghost notes in the second half of the second chorus of the blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, geez, really? The ghost notes on a snare drum. Or those hi-hat hits. Yeah, it's like, and everyone pays attention to their instrument too, a little too much.
Yeah, I'd say definitely. You mentioned compression before. I'm just curious, do you have a favorite compressor that you use in the box?
Yes, and right now I'm using the, it's a Puigtech, the Waves Puigtech 670, you know, the Fairchild,
yeah,
whatever, the little copy of it. And I've owned a 670 before, and I've sold it, but it's different. It's not like a 670, a real 670. It's different, but it's good. And the thing about the different emulations, because UA also has a Fairchild emulation, is they sound different from each other too, you know.
Yeah.
The Puigtech is a little more aggressive and a little grainier, and for that reason I like it on the stereo bus, because I can make things hit a little harder. But the UA is also a good, the UA 670 emulation is also really good, but I'll use that for something else entirely because it's cleaner. I'll usually use that for a drum sidechain.
Mm. When you're, especially on the stereo bus, how aggressive are you with compression? Are you hitting it hard or just a little bit to get the sound?
I used to hit it a lot harder, but then I realized that this is not really sounding that great. Because the window on the computer shows me a 670, I go straight towards my old settings on a real analog 670, and you can't do that. You really need to just barely touch the plug-in version to make it sound good. Otherwise, it just is too much. And that goes with a lot of the plug-in compression in the box. I think that you can go way overboard and it just doesn't sound good. It kind of makes everything choked.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I agree.
So I have a light touch. I go for a light touch nowadays. And I leave the rest of it up to the mastering engineer.
When you're mixing, do you have a template that you start with that has effects that you pretty much know you're going to use, or you just do it as you go along?
I very much have a template, yeah. And I think that saves a lot of time. My template will have 8 different categories, let's say, for instruments. So I have my drum category, and then I have a sum for that I have a compressor on. And I also have, for the drums, I have a subharmonic emulator. I have what I call a spank, which is an aggressive compressor for just the kick and snare. And I have a delay and a reverb aux input. So each category will have a set of these, you know, effects, auxes, and then an aux for the sum that I can use a compression on if I want to, or an overall EQ for, you know, the bass. The bass I like to have, I'm using, let's see, a couple different things, but lately I use the JJP bass effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I very much use templates. I have a template set up for rock music that I will plug in mixes, and I'll start there, and then I'll replace things in the template as I go.
How about EQ? I know when you're tracking something and then mixing it, it's completely different than when you get something into mix. Do you find yourself being very aggressive EQ-wise?
In the mix?
Yeah.
Yeah, if I tracked it, most of the work is done analog. If I'm using someone else, if I'm mixing someone else's work, I'll probably be more aggressive with the EQ in the box. Yeah, but generally when I track, let's say guitars, I'll engage the 1073 EQ and I'll use that to get the sound that I want. I like to record in a way where I'm mixing, pre-mixing as we're tracking. So I know exactly what the finished sound will be. And I generally pan things a certain way and I group things a certain way so that it's all close to being finished when we're done tracking.
Yeah. How long do your mixes take as a result?
If I track it, the mixes will not take that long. If it's someone else's work, it usually takes longer. And it really depends, too. The first mix of an album will take the most time. I might spend a whole day on the first mix on an album, getting the sound. And then the additional mixes will take less time.
Yeah, yeah, that
yeah.
makes sense.
I think mixing in the box is because of the using templates and streamlining, it takes less time than doing the analog flying faders mixing. However, I really miss just being able to grab five faders at once and move. And, you know, one pass, I used to do five things in one pass because I would be grabbing all kinds of things. Now you have to kind of work on one section and, you know, yeah.
Well, I go back to the old days before automation where you mixed and you had five people, both hands on the console.
Yeah.
And there was something really organically lovely about that. It just felt really good because it was a ballet that you were doing. You know, it was a mix on top of the mix almost.
A performance.
And it's just something about it that was very cool that, of course, we don't do that today. Right, so I take it you're using a mouse then to mix. You're not using a work surface?
I have a Raven that I use the touch screen. I also have a mouse and I have a keyboard in front of me too. So I use a hybrid approach where I'm, but I mainly stay on the edit screen on Pro Tools so I can see the waveforms and I can bounce around in the mix wherever I need to easily. I don't usually use the mix screen on Pro Tools.
Okay, no, that makes sense. Well, tell me about the Raven. I haven't talked to a lot of people that are using it in a serious manner. Like on your level, for instance. And I'm just curious how you got into it. And do you have arm fatigue? That's the one thing I've always wondered. If I have to keep on reaching, am I going to get tennis elbow from that?
You know, there is something to say about the arm fatigue. So the Raven is very close to me and I will have my hand up and I'm usually using my left hand to run the Raven and my right hand to hold onto the mouse or to use the keyboard. So, yeah, most of the Raven is used in the presets and some of the transport control. So because it's a hybrid, I never get that fatigue that you're talking about.
Okay. All right. So tell me about your book.
Well, the book was kind of a fluke. And I've been collecting stories from people for years. I always thought that there was something that had not been written about experimentation in the studio, which I love to do. And since I had been collecting photos and stories of my own experiments, plus these things that other people do, I thought it was about time to put something together. And I also do illustrations. So I was able to illustrate several of these techniques, like how to build your own Cooper Time Cube, for instance. And if you don't know what a Cooper Time Cube is, basically in the 70s, they built this device that was an analog delay. And the way it worked was it was a box that had basically a garden hose in it. And on one end was a speaker going into the hose. And on the other end of the hose was a little microphone. And you would send signal through this device and there would be a little delay. So you would recognize the sound on Queen records and John Lennon. And I mean, it was a popular effect in the 70s. So I bought one of these devices, the original 70s Cooper Time Cubes, and opened it up and looked inside and I saw how it was built. And I thought, well, anyone could build one of these. Let's try it. So I got a regular old garden hose from the hardware store and I stuck an Auratone on the end with a funnel. So the sound is being pushed into the hose. And I put an SM57 on the other end and taped it on there. And ran sound through it, and it's fantastic. And it's much, it's actually versatile in the sense that you can adjust it to the exact delay that you want. The original Cooper Time Cube, there was two settings, two lengths. But here, if you have a scissors and a garden hose, you can pretty much make it the length that you want. Just if you're doing an album project, you want to start with the longest, the slowest song first, because, you know, as you cut your hose shorter, you're going to get a faster slap. Anyway, so that was one of the stories. There's all kinds of photos from contributors. There's several people, that helped contribute, including Al Schmidt and geez, dozens of people. Hans Zimmer and Ed Stasium has some great stories. Matt Wallace, and there's many great stories about how they got certain sounds. For instance, Bob Clearmountain talks about how he used the women's bathroom at a studio to get the classic sound and the reverb sound that they used on a Bruce Springsteen album. There's all kinds of stories of stairwell reverbs and recording in a pyramid and recording in a bathtub and things that you wouldn't expect, because these are albums that you probably know, but you didn't know that this is how they were made. So it's a fun book, and I got to illustrate it, and it's doing quite well. It came out on Hal Leonard last year, and it's actually doing quite well.
How long did it take you to write?
It was about a year, and some of that was solid work on it, because I never knew how much work it took to write a book. Well, you know. But yeah, the editing process and getting all the permissions, especially because I had 35 people also contributing, and I needed to get permission from them, and photos and photo clearances and all this stuff. So it was a great learning experience, and I can't wait to write the next book. I'm planning on writing a book, a more serious book on artists and some of the challenges they face in the book would be called The Collateral Damage of Big Art, and it's about musicians and artists and other creative people that and we all know them. They generally are so obsessed or consumed in their work that they the rest of their lives just kind of fall apart. And it could be relationships, it could be finances, it could be substance abuse. And I really want to do a study on that and learn why certain people are immune to those pitfalls. You know, certain people, like I can imagine Peter Gabriel is one where he has not been affected by fame in a negative way, where he's gone on to be a great businessman. He owns SSL,
Yeah,
you
right.
know.
Hall and Oates, same thing.
Hall and Oates, right. So some people rise above that, but a lot of them get caught up in this kind of obsession that is somewhat it's kind of not healthy, and I want to make a study of that.
That's an awesome idea. And I don't think it's been done before that I know of, at least outside of a scientific journal. And even then, I don't know. I haven't read anything, and I see a lot of those journals and kind of on top of the latest in terms of artistic cognitive responses. One last question, Sylvia, and I'll let you go. What is the best piece of business advice that you received from somebody, or maybe you've learned along the way? Did someone just tell you something that was kind of like an aha moment?
Well, you know, I have to say that the advice of never saying you can't do something. I think that if a client asks you, hey, can we do this or can you do this? And you say no, for whatever reason, you're I think that's just a terrible thing to do. And so I've just learned to, even if in my mind I'm saying, God, no,
Yeah,
I will always be encouraging, and I'll say, well, let's try it, you know, or we can try, or yes, let's do it. And if it means that they learn something and learn that it's better to just let that idea go. I think a mistake that I've made is actually telling an artist that they had a bad idea, and that was just terrible, and I regret that, but I don't do that anymore.
we've all been there, I think, with that.
Yeah.
So I empathize with you, unfortunately, on that part. If you want to find more about Sylvia, you can go to sylviamassey.com, S-Y-L-V-I-A-M-A-S-S-Y, one word, sylviamassey.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.